Chapter 9. X-Rays. I joined the army, as its slogan went, to be all I could be. And also because it wasn't the Coast Guard. It didn't hurt that I'd scored high enough on its entrance exams to qualify for a chance to come out of training as a Special Forces sergeant on a track the recruiters called 18 X-Ray, which was designed to augment the ranks of the small, flexible units that were doing the hardest fighting in America's increasingly shadowy and disparate wars. The 18 X-Ray program was a considerable incentive, because traditionally, before 9/11, I would have had to already be in the Army before being given a shot at attending the Special Forces' exceedingly demanding qualification courses. The new system worked by screening prospective soldiers up front, identifying those with the highest levels of fitness, intelligence, and language learning ability, the ones who might make the cut, and using the inducements of special training and a rapid advance in rank to enlist promising candidates who might otherwise go elsewhere. I'd put in a couple of months of grueling runs to prepare. I was in great shape, but I always hated running, before my recruiter called to say that my paperwork was approved. I was in. I'd made it. I was the first candidate he'd ever signed up for the program, and I could hear the pride and cheer in his voice when he told me that after training, I'd probably be made a Special Forces Communications, Engineering, or Intelligence Sergeant. Probably. But first, I had to get through basic training at Fort Benning, Georgia. I sat next to the same guy the whole way down there, from bus to plane to bus, Maryland to Georgia. He was enormous, a puffy bodybuilder, somewhere between 200 and 300 pounds. He talked nonstop, his conversation alternating between describing how he'd slap the drill sergeant in the face if he gave him any lip and recommending the steroid cycles I should take to most effectively bulk up. I don't think he took a breath until we arrived at Fort Benning's Sandhill training area, which in hindsight, I have to say, didn't actually seem to have that much sand. The drill sergeants greeted us with withering fury and gave us nicknames based on our initial infractions and grave mistakes, like getting off the bus wearing a brightly colored floral patterned shirt, or having a name that could be modified slightly into something funnier. Soon, I was Snowflake, and my seatmate was Daisy, and all he could do was clench his jaw. Nobody dared to clench a fist and fume. Once the drill sergeants noticed that Daisy and I were already acquainted, and that I was the lightest in the platoon at 5'9" and 124 pounds, and he the heaviest, they decided to entertain themselves by pairing us together as often as possible. I still remember the buddy carry, an exercise where you had to carry your supposedly wounded partner the length of a football field, using a number of different methods, like the neck drag, the fireman, and the especially comedic bridle carry. When I had to carry Daisy, you couldn't see me beneath his bulk. It would look like Daisy was floating, though I'd be under him, sweating and cursing, straining to get his gigantic ass to the other side of the goal line before collapsing myself. Daisy would then get up with a laugh, drape me around his neck like a damp towel, and go skipping along like a child in the woods. We were always dirty and always hurting, but within weeks I was in the best shape of my life. My slight build, which had seemed like a curse, soon became an advantage, because so much of what we did were body weight exercises. Daisy couldn't climb a rope, which I scampered up like a chipmunk. He struggled to lift his incredible bulk above the bar for the bare minimum of pull-ups, while I could do twice the number with one arm. He could barely manage a handful of push-ups before breaking a sweat, whereas I could do them with claps or with just a single thumb. When we did the 2-minute push-up tests, they stopped me early for maxing the score. Everywhere we went, we marched or ran. We ran constantly. Miles before mess, miles after mess, down roads and fields and around the track, while the drill sergeant called cadence. I went to the desert where the terrorists run. Pulled out my machete, pulled out my gun. Left, right, kill, kill, kill. Mess with us and you know we will. I went to the caves where the terrorists hide. Pulled out a grenade and threw it inside. Left, right, kill, kill, kill. Mess with us, and you know we will. Running in unit formation, calling cadence. It lulls you. It puts you outside yourself, filling your ears with the din of dozens of men echoing your own shouting voice and forcing your eyes to fix on the footfalls of the runner in front of you. After a while, you don't think anymore. You merely count, and your mind dissolves into the rank and file as you pace out mile after mile. I would say it was serene if it wasn't so deadening. I would say I was at peace if I weren't so tired. This was precisely as the army intended. The drill sergeant goes unslapped not so much because of fear, but because of exhaustion. He's never worth the effort. The army makes its fighters by first training the fight out of them until they're too weak to care or to do anything besides obey. It was only at night in the barracks that we would get some respite, which we had to earn by toeing the line in front of our bunks, reciting the Soldier's Creed, and then singing the Star-Spangled Banner. Daisy would always forget the words. Also, he was tone-deaf. Some guys would stay up late talking about what they were going to do to bin Laden once they found him, and they were all sure they were going to find him. Most of their fantasies had to do with decapitation, castration, or horny camels. Meanwhile, I'd have dreams about running, not through the lush and loamy Georgia landscape, but through the desert. Sometime during the third or fourth week, we were out on a land navigation movement, which is when your platoon goes into the woods and treks over variegated terrain to predetermined coordinates, clambering over boulders and wading across streams with just a map and a compass. No GPS, no digital technology. We'd done versions of this movement before, but never in full kit, with each of us lugging a rucksack stuffed with around 50 pounds of gear. Worse still, the raw boots the army had issued me were so wide that I floated in them. I felt my toes blister even as I set out, loping across the range. Toward the middle of the movement, I was on point and scrambled atop a storm-felled tree that arched over the path at about chest height so that I could shoot an azimuth to check our bearings. After confirming that we were on track, I went to hop down, but with one foot extended, I noticed the coil of a snake directly below me. I'm not exactly a naturalist, so I don't know what species of snake it was, but then again, I didn't really care. Kids in North Carolina grow up being told that all snakes are deadly, and I wasn't about to start doubting it now. Instead, I started trying to walk on air. I widened the stride of my outstretched foot once, twice, twisting for the extra distance, when suddenly I realized I was falling. When my feet hit the ground some distance beyond the snake, a fire shot up my legs that was more painful than any viper bite I could imagine. A few stumbling steps, which I had to take in order to regain my balance, told me that something was wrong, grievously wrong. I was in excruciating pain, but I couldn't stop because I was in the army, and the army was in the middle of the woods. I gathered my resolve, pushed the pain away, and just focused on maintaining a steady pace, left, right, relying on the rhythm to distract me. It got harder to walk as I went on, and although I managed to tough it out and finish, the only reason was that I didn't have a choice. By the time I got back to the barracks, my legs were numb. My rack or bunk was up top, and I could barely get myself into it. I had to grab its post, hoist up my torso like I was getting out of a pool, and drag my lower half in after. The next morning, I was torn from a fitful sleep by the clanking of a metal trash can being thrown down the squad bay, a wake-up call that meant someone hadn't done their job to the drill sergeant's satisfaction. I shot up automatically, swinging myself over the edge and springing to the floor. When I landed, my legs gave way. They crumpled and I fell. It was like I had no legs at all. I tried to get up, grabbing for the lower bunk to try my hoist-by-the-arms maneuver again, but as soon as I moved my legs, every muscle in my body seized and I sank down immediately. Meanwhile, a crowd had gathered around me, with laughter that turned to concern and then to silence as the drill sergeant approached.
"What's the matter with you, broke dick?" he said. "Get up off my floor before I make you a part of it permanently."
When he saw the agony flash across my face, As I immediately and unwisely struggled to respond to his commands, he put his hand on my chest to stop me.
Daisy, get Snowflake here down to the bench.
Then he crouched down over me, as if he didn't want the others to hear him being gentle, and said in a quiet rasp,
"As soon as it opens, Private, you're gonna crutch your broken ass to sick call."
Which is where the Army sends its injured to be abused by professionals. There's a major stigma about getting injured in the Army, mostly because the Army is dedicated to making its soldiers feel invincible, but also because it likes to protect itself from accusations of mistraining. This is why almost all training injury victims are treated like whiners or, worse, malingerers. After he carried me down to the bench, Daisy had to go. He wasn't hurt, and those of us who were had to be kept separated. We were the untouchables, the lepers, the soldiers who couldn't train because of anything from sprains, lacerations, and burns to broken ankles and deep necrotized spider bites. My new battle buddies would now come from this bench of shame. A battle buddy is the person who, by policy, goes everywhere you go, just as you go everywhere they go, if there's even the remotest chance that either of you might be alone. Being alone might lead to thinking, and thinking can cause the Army problems. The battle buddy assigned to me was a smart, handsome, former catalog model Captain America type who'd injured his hip about a week earlier but hadn't attended to it until the pain had become unbearable and left him just as gimpy as me. Neither of us felt up to talking, so we crutched along in grim silence, left, right, but slowly. At the hospital, I was x-rayed and told that I had bilateral tibial fractures. These are stress fractures, fissures on the surface of the bones that can deepen with time and pressure until they crack the bones down to the marrow. The only thing I could do to help my legs heal was to get off my feet and stay off them. It was with those orders that I was dismissed from the examination room to get a ride back to the battalion. Except I couldn't go yet, because I couldn't leave without my battle buddy. He'd gone in to be x-rayed after me and hadn't returned. I assumed he was still being examined, so I waited. And waited. Hours passed. I spent the time reading newspapers and magazines, an unthinkable luxury for someone in basic training. A nurse came over and said my drill sergeant was on the phone at the desk. By the time I hobbled over to take the call, he was livid.
"Snowflake, you enjoying your reading? Maybe you could get some pudding while you're at it, and some copies of Cosmo for the girls. Why in the hell haven't you two dirtbags left yet?"
"Drill, Sarn." That's how everybody said it in Georgia, where my southern accent had resurfaced for the moment.
"I'm still waiting on my battle buddy, Drill Sarn."
"And where the fuck is he, Snowflake?"
"Drill Sarn, I don't know. He went into the examination room and hasn't come out, Drill Sarn."
He wasn't happy with the answer, and barked even louder.
"Get off your crippled ass and go fucking find him, goddammit!"
I got up and crutched over to the intake counter to make inquiries. My battle buddy, they told me, was in surgery. It was only toward evening, after a barrage of calls from the drill sergeant, that I found out what had happened. My battle buddy had been walking around on a broken hip for the past week, apparently, and if he hadn't been taken into surgery immediately and had it screwed back together, he might have been incapacitated for life. Major nerves could have been severed because the break was as sharp as a knife. I was sent back to Fort Benning alone, back to the bench. Anybody on the bench for more than 3 or 4 days was at serious risk of being recycled, forced to start basic training over from scratch, or worse, of being transferred to the medical unit and sent home. These were the guys who dreamed of being in the Army their entire lives, guys for whom the Army had been their only way out of cruel families and dead-end careers, who now had to face the prospect of failure and a return to civilian life irreparably damaged. We were the cast-offs, the walking wounded hell guard who had no other duty than to sit on a bench in front of a brick wall 12 hours a day. We had been judged by our injuries as unfit for the Army and now had to pay for this fact by being separated and shunned. As if the drill sergeants feared we'd contaminate others with our weakness or with the ideas that had occurred to us while benched. We were punished beyond the pain of our injuries themselves, excluded from petty joys like watching the fireworks on the 4th of July. Instead, we pulled fire guard that night for the empty barracks, a task that involved watching to make sure that the empty building didn't burn down. We pulled fire guard two to a shift, and I stood in the dark on my crutches, pretending to be useful alongside my partner. He was a sweet, simple, beefy 18-year-old with a dubious, perhaps self-inflicted injury. By his own account, he should never have enlisted to begin with. The fireworks were bursting in the distance while he told me how much of a mistake he'd made and how agonizingly lonely he was, how much he missed his parents and his home, their family farm somewhere way out in Appalachia. I sympathized, though there wasn't much I could do but send him to speak to the chaplain. I tried to offer advice, suck it up, it might be better once you're used to it. But then he put his bulk in front of me, and in an endearingly childlike way, told me point blank that he was going AWOL, a crime in the military, and asked me whether I would tell anybody. It was only then that I noticed he'd brought his laundry bag. He meant that he was going AWOL that very moment. I wasn't sure how to deal with the situation, beyond trying to talk some sense into him. I warned him that going AWOL was a bad idea, that he'd end up with a warrant out for his arrest and any cop in the country could pick him up for the rest of his life. But the guy shook his head. Where he lived, he said, deep in the mountains, they didn't even have cops. This, he said, was his last chance to be free. I understood then that his mind was made up. He was much more mobile than I was, and he was big. If he ran, I couldn't chase him. If I tried to stop him, he might snap me in half. All I could do was report him. But if I did, I'd be penalized for having let the conversation get this far without calling for reinforcements and beating him with a crutch. I was angry. I realized I was yelling at him. Why didn't he wait until I was in the latrine and make a break for it? Why was he putting me in this position? He spoke softly. "You're the only one who listens," he said, and began to cry. The saddest part of that night is that I believed him. In the company of a 250, he was alone. We stood in silence as the fireworks popped and snapped in the distance. I sighed and said, "I've got to go to the latrine. I'm going to be a while." Then I limped away and didn't look back. That was the last I ever saw of him. I think I realized then and there that I wasn't long for the Army either. My next doctor's appointment was merely confirmation. The doctor was a tall, lanky Southerner with a wry demeanor. After examining me and a new set of X-rays, he said that I was in no condition to continue with my company. The next phase of training was airborne. And he told me, "Son, if you jump on those legs, they're gonna turn into powder." I was despondent. If I didn't finish the basic training cycle on time, I'd lose my slot in 18X, which meant that I'd be reassigned according to the needs of the Army. They could make me into whatever they wanted: regular infantry, a mechanic, a desk jockey, a potato peeler, or, in my greatest nightmare, doing IT at the Army's help desk. The doctor must have seen how dejected I was, because he cleared his throat and gave me a choice. I could get recycled and try my luck with reassignment, or he could write me a note, putting me on what was called administrative separation. This, he explained, was a special type of severance, not characterized as either honorable or dishonorable, only available to enlistees who'd been in the service fewer than 6 months. It was a clean break, more like an annulment than a divorce, and could be taken care of rather quickly. I'll admit the idea appealed to me. In the back of my mind, I even thought it might be some kind of karmic reward for the mercy I'd shown to the Appalachian who'd gone AWOL. The doctor left me to think, and when he came back in an hour, I accepted his offer. Shortly thereafter, I was transferred to the medical unit, where I was told that in order for the administrative separation to go through, I had to sign a statement attesting that I was all better, that my bones were all healed. My signature was a requirement, but it was presented as a mere formality, just a few scribbles, and I could go. As I held the statement in one hand and the pen in the other, a knowing smile crossed my face. I recognized the hack. What I'd thought was a kind and generous offer made by a caring army doctor to an ailing enlistee was the government's way of avoiding liability and a disability claim. Under the military's rules, if I'd received a medical discharge, the government would have had to pay the bills for any issues stemming from my injury, any treatments and therapies it required. An administrative discharge put the burden on me, and my freedom hinged on my willingness to accept that burden. I signed and left that same day on crutches that the Army let me keep.